The first is that one organization, it's no longer a hybrid organization, but one organization can embody both a commercial aspect as well as be socially driven. And the second is through that organization you can actually leverage non-traditional or non-public financing sources that address some of the big issues in development aid. So development architecture currently is a grant-based system. It has a lot of volatility, fickleness in the way funding comes in. So funding may come into a program for 3 to 5 years. When you're talking about point-of-use water or providing households at the base of the pyramid sustainable access to safe drinking water, you need to look at a longer period than 3 to 5 years to see health impact. So it's one of the big challenges that I have faced, and where really the evolution of this project has started. So just to give you a little bit of background, I work for a company called Vestergaard Fransen. It is built on a humanitarian entrepreneurship model of business, so profit for a purpose. It is a for-profit company, but its whole mission, vision, values is around research and development and innovation of technologies, integrated program development models to bring efficient and cost-effective health services to base of the pyramid populations. So it's a family-owned organization. It originally looked at, do we want to build a CSR component to our work? And the CEO really decided, I'd rather, instead of creating a CSR arm that's not sustainable, create an entire business model around CSR, so around some of the fundamental social values of that. So we are built into 4 main business units, the public health business unit, which really looks predominantly at vector control. So we are the largest manufacturer and producer of long-lasting insecticide-treated mosquito nets for malaria prevention, but we've also done a lot of other innovation in insecticide-treated technologies for vector control and water as it relates to public health. We have a food security group, a climate group, and the climate group is the business unit that I manage, and that's how do you really link environmental outcomes to health and development outcomes. So as you do development work or health initiatives that actively contribute to Millennium Development Goals 4, 5, and 6, how do you do it in an environmentally friendly way? And then we have a consumer water division that looks at joint ventures in some countries. So today I really want to talk about one specific project that I am running in Kenya. And the project originated out of a partnership that we made with the government of Kenya in 2008. To give you a very quick history on that, the company's been active in Kenya for 17 years. In 2008 was our 50-year anniversary of our company, and as a 50-year anniversary celebration, our CEO did not want to throw a big party, but wanted to show the world that integrated health services could provide huge value to the community, development community. And so he implemented what was called an integrated prevention campaign, which incentivized voluntary testing and counseling for HIV with the provision of a basic care pack of services, so an insecticide-treated mosquito net, condoms, IEC materials, and a water filter. So anybody who came in for voluntary testing and counseling got the care pack, regardless of whether they tested or not, and regardless of whether they were positive or not. All positives were linked into the government system, given CD4 counts on site. And this model of an integrated voluntary testing and counseling program achieved 40,000 testing. So we tested 40,000 people, or more than 80% of the population in that area, in 6 days. We then decided with the government that we really needed to scale this approach up. So how do you take all the lessons learned, cost efficiencies, effectiveness, reduction of stigma in these populations through this integrated approach, and build it into something much bigger? And we tried to get a number of funders to the table. So Global Fund had money for mosquito nets, and PEPFAR had financing for voluntary testing and counseling, and we were going to bring in the financing for the water component. And after a year of bringing everybody to the table, we had, of course, delays in funding from Global Fund and PEPFAR, and the government asked us to move ahead with the water component on our own. So my job in this space was to look at how do you create innovative financing around providing nearly 1 million households in Western Kenya with a water filter. And each of these households were unable to afford a market-based solution for this. So outside of traditional development funding, are there any other sources of sustainable finance that we could bring to this project? So in 2011, we implemented the first ever carbon-financed water program. So it linked funding for this program through international carbon markets, and it's done it in a very interesting way. So while a grant pays for you to implement a program, you get upfront financing through a grant to implement a program, this is a very traditional pay-for-performance model of program implementation. So I had to go to the board and ask for a $30 million investment to bring this program out. Luckily, I have a very risk-tolerant board, and the board backed me on that $30 million investment with really no guarantee that the money would come back in. The way it works is that it's registered under a carbon emissions methodology, reduction methodology, that if there is a reduction in actual boiling or even projected boiling as demand would increase in that area, that you have an offset. And that translates into carbon credits. Carbon credits are then sold on the market. But the way that is measured is by behavior change. You have to show that you have technology adoption and how much they use the filter. So this is the first water program that ever revenue comes in directly tied to behavior change outcomes. So just to give you a brief idea of the scale, in 6 weeks, we had a team of 8,000 employees, Kenyan employees, 4,000 of which were community health workers. We partnered with the government to hire and train them, and we went door to door to 877,000 households in that 6 weeks. So we saw about 40,000 households a day, and we spent 45 minutes to 1 hour in every single household, training the entire household and on the filter, but also doing a lot of health education and behavior change communication messaging around both safe water as well as sanitation. We have a full-time program running since that time. So in the province, there are 32 districts. In every district, we have repair and replacement centers. We have a network of 40 individuals that man each of those, but then we have a network of 14,000 volunteers that we maintain year-round to give us eyes and ears on the ground in every village and sublocation about what are the risk factors of non-use of the filter, are there any problems with the filters that we can provide the free repair and replacement. And then every 6 months, which we're in the middle of right now, so I flew in from Nairobi last night, or from Kakamega last night, and I fly back out tonight. We're in the middle of a training and education campaign, so every 6 weeks we send 2,000 community health workers back to every household to retrain and do health education. And every 6 months we have mapped the risk factors that we see emerging. So the last training and education campaign was really focused on safe storage. This training and education campaign is really focused on some of the sanitation messaging around hand washing. So what we do over time is and I'll speak a little bit about the database as it moves forward, but we use database and real-time data to map what all the risk factors are and how to adapt the program, and then every 6 months we're back in each one of those households. And because the filter itself has a barcode on it, we do surveys with smartphones in every household, and we can track data over time. So who are the stakeholders? We work very, very closely with the government of Kenya. We have a memorandum of understanding that is signed by six ministries, so Ministry of Gender, Ministry of Education, Ministry of Health, Ministry of Public Health and Sanitation, Ministry of Environment, and the Treasury. To get that many signatures from the Kenyan government on one page was a huge endeavor, and one that caused a lot of gray hair. But since then, it's been hugely beneficial, so it's one of the critical success factors for this project. We work all the way down to the community-level WASH programs, community-based organizations. We work closely in the schools across the province because the change agents for a water technology in the household linked to kitchen use is generally children between the age of 9 and 14. So we work closely with the Ministry of Education as well. Why it's so interesting, especially in this context, so it does provide a link between carbon offset, reduction of biomass use, and providing a non-energy-based solution to water purification. It is pay-for-performance, so that's the one thing that really excited me about this model, is it's putting your money where your mouth is. So the company has taken a $30 million risk to put this out here. It does have potential. You know, it should pay back over a 3 to 4 year payback time, and then we'll be profitable after that. So it's interesting from a commercial perspective, and that profit then gets reinvested in how do you look at additional innovative financing mechanisms, how do you take this to scale, or how do we create new design for improved products. And it creates a whole new incentive structure for a project implementer. And so while you have, as a grant recipient that I was for many years, you get upfront money and you implement a program and you do report on it, but there's no actual incentive to push the boundaries on how much behavior change you can not just achieve but then sustain. So this model actually creates an entire commercial incentive as well as a programmatic incentive to move the indicators as far as you can, monitor them very robustly, and then, you know, every 6 months to know constantly how you're doing on those indicators. And the critical success factors that we'll talk about moving forward is around this database. So in the original distribution, we had the 8,000 employees, 4,000 of which were community health workers, and we gave each community health worker a smartphone. We developed the back-end database and the front-end application to do a number of things. And we were looking at three innovations in how to use mobile technology around this. How do you use it to manage your program, which I'll speak a bit about. How do you use it to monitor more tactical or strategic indicators of the program? And then how do you measure health impact with the smartphone technology? So the first one's about managing the program. Because we were able to give 4,000 community health workers these phones, every household they went into, we have demographic information now, basic survey information, GPS. We have now mapped more than 90% of the households, or 4.5 million people in the province. So it's better data than the census itself. And the government has full access to this data for their health plans. But also what it does is it gives us every single day real-time data. 40,000 uploads go up a day. And we can see what time every single community health worker started work, how long they spent in every household. Because it's a tool to remind them of all the education points they have to do, I know exactly how long it took them to do a demonstration of the filter and how long it took them to get through the behavior change communication pieces. And what your database does is it spits out to every different level reports. So at the operational level, to a team leader, they see a report every single day of the average times for their 10 community health workers. And it moves up the chain, and I see a sort of strategic indicator report every day. But you have this drill down possibility on these phones. And the reports actually come in on the phones too. So anybody carrying the phones gets their own report as well as the report for the team they're managing. It's a little bit like Big Brother, I realize, but it's very helpful to manage a team of 4,000 to 8,000 people at a time. We do use it over time, so our full-time program uses it as well. It allows us to track information, risk indicators over time, but also to quickly respond. So if we see emerging issues in one area, we can address them within 24-hour period or 1 month period. You don't have to do surveys every 6 months, and then from the surveys, you have 2 months of analysis, and then 8 months later, you're responding to some of the issues that come up. So the database has been hugely helpful there. And then we'll speak a little bit in a minute about how we use it to measure impact. How do we do the basic measurements? We do it in three different tiers. One of the issues about being a for-profit company and measuring impact is that you have to do it very robustly, very transparently, and have three different levels of verification just to maintain sort of credibility and transparency in how we're measuring progress. So every 6 months when we're in the households, We have specifically trained surveyors that do about 19,000 surveys every 6 months, 19,000 households, and a long comprehensive, it's about a 70-question survey about usage, consumption, behavior change. From that, we have an external agency that comes in and takes a subsample of that survey and a subsample outside and verifies what's in our database is correct and what it, and that it's representative of the outside population. And then finally, every 6 months, we have a UN auditor and their team that come in that do that both verify us as well as the external agency. For the first 6 months, we looked at, so this was the $30 million initial investment, and then every year we have about $5 million that's reinvested just in behavior change communication and health messaging into these going back to each household campaigns. And this is all, again, reimbursed through the carbon market, so it doesn't depend on any public funding. So in the first 6 months, we got about 91% of households reporting that they use the filter, so technology adoption. 83% report that they use it at least twice a week, and why this is important is that's the indicator in that part of Western Kenya that identifies that they're not drinking contaminated water. So that is what is most closely linked to their storage behaviors, that they would not be mixing, sometimes drinking contaminated and sometimes not. And that their consumption for health-related purposes is about 3 liters per person per day. And this equated to an offset of about 1.35 million carbon credits for the first 6 months, which is 10 times larger than any other project on the market. And that includes large-scale wind projects or clean energy industrial projects in China and India. So it's not enough to say that we want to change the behavior and we want to measure that, but we actually need to see how this impacts on health indicators. So it's great to say that we have distributed these filters, and it's great to say that carbon revenue is coming in, but if we're not having a health impact on the community, then it's not worth it. So we have partnered with Oxford University, who's doing 2 health impact evaluations of the project, one on children under 5 and one on people living with HIV and AIDS. The first on children under 5 is a case control study design, 14 randomized clinics, and there's more specifics here that we don't need to go through. This is the whole region, and this is just where the clinics are. Need to go through that. But again, we have a very strong connection with our mobile data collection processes here. And so what we have done in collaboration with Oxford and our PI is we have created an upfront application that connects into the database that actually replicates the IMCI algorithm. So for every child under 5, we have given all the clinicians an application that takes them specifically through every question they need to ask in the Integrated Management of Childhood Illness algorithm that the WHO has approved and Kenya uses. It follows all the standardized case definition and calculate and pulls all the information, again, that goes between Oxford because they're doing the study, and it goes directly into the health services that they can use the information in real time. But it allows us to look at a number of different things. This is just the algorithm, if anybody's not familiar with it, and how a clinician would go through it. If there's any symptoms or indicators of a waterborne illness, it will prompt with Oxford's additional water questions at the end, which is the health impact evaluation from this project. So next steps, again, at each clinic, we know that this is reported data, so just like it's reported usage, we want to be a little bit more robust in that and look at, then in a case definition, you have reported diarrhea, which has the same issue. If somebody's going to report, is there reporting bias in a survey? So we're introducing laboratory diagnostic for stool pathogens and household level water quality testing for patients that come in. So we're able to go to the house and look at volumes of pathogens in the stool and see a reduction or not, as well as testing water, household water quality testing, so reported usage, and map that to actual usage. We also, as part of our HIV study, have developed an electronic medical record system for the government facilities there, and this is now being implemented. It was started in 2009 with that integrated prevention campaign that I told you about, but we've really built that out now. So We have a group, their provincial general hospital, their HIV clinic there uses this electronic medical record system now. Again, like the smartphone technology, it prompts if there's any symptoms for waterborne illness with these modules. But we've actually created modules and cell phone applications for the HIV component. The government's just asked us to do this for maternal and child health indicators as well. So out of this has spun this whole new mobile technology and EMR systems that has been such a, you know, such a big value to the government itself. They've asked us to broaden it. And what are the implications? So again, what we like to do is integrate as much as possible and be as cost efficient and cost effective as possible. So great that we're going to invest as a company in health impact studies. Health impact studies can be expensive, so if we're going to invest in them, then we want to do it in a way that contributes to the existing health system. So can we use our mobile-based system and the methodologies that we're using in the health impact studies to strengthen the pathways of care that exist there as well? So we're looking at a number of different things in addition to the health impact is can you improve standardization of care for outpatients? Can you link outpatient and inpatient? A number of things, again, that fall outside of the scope, but what we're trying to bring together. So what's next? What's next for us? This is the question I usually get for anybody who has any experience in carbon markets. Have you looked at carbon markets in the last 6 months, Allison? Because they've totally fallen apart. And the answer to that is that's mostly true. As we get towards the end of 2012, the Kyoto Treaty expires and the obligations under those expire too. So it's caused volatility in the carbon market itself. So the next step is to look at what are the really interesting lessons learned from this pay-for-performance or results-based payment model, and how do we build them into global health indicator development as well. So you can use still carbon finance, but those numbers are decreasing. It's more of like a subsidy. What we've talked about with USAID and DFID and under a number of other donor organizations is can they build in indicator measurements and pay for results of a project instead of building it into a grant. So the space, the policy space we're working in right now is creating a health impact market where donors are actually paying for how much a project moves indicators and not for implementing the program itself. And that in collaboration with financing like carbon-based financing should be able to make these projects sustainable in the long run. And the other things we're looking at is linking some of these other areas, waste to energy, food security, scaling up water interventions, and how do you link in rural electrification. Is that okay? Questions?
Thank you.
Welcome. Yes.
Everything.
Yeah.
Okay. So can you repeat the question?
Yeah. So the first question is one that we get often, and it is also a bottle of wine question, but we'll start. It is surprising to her, having lived in the area, that that many people boil their water. And the question is, she's absolutely right, they don't. 20 to 30%, depending on where you are, actually boiled their water as a baseline. What happens in carbon finance, so this is going to get a little bit technical, but carbon experts have built the Clean Development Mechanism and the gold standard, these two carbon markets, to allow developing countries to leapfrog into clean technologies. And to do that, what they acknowledge explicitly is something called suppressed demand for energy. So they acknowledge in a place like Western Kenya, 20 to 30% actually boil their water. Access to firewood is sometimes difficult or expensive. And that poverty or access becomes a barrier to how much biomass they use. So if resources were there and were free of charge, more people would boil, or as the economic development happens, the understanding is more people would boil. So the issue of suppressed demand is they will allow a minimum threshold taken on a usual, you know, an evidence-based trajectory of energy use. And the minimum threshold is set by WHO for drinking water, and it says this is the minimum amount of drinking water that any family living in that environment should have on a daily basis. So they allow the acknowledgement of suppressed demand for that amount, up to a minimum threshold of water used per day. So you are absolutely right on the first one, and it's part of the carbon markets explicitly put in there to allow pretty much African countries to access carbon markets. To leverage this idea called suppressed demand.
And it seems like that's one of the, that would be a fabulous reason why the carbon markets are considered really geeky and aren't really having much impact on
CO2. Right. So it is an adjustment. If you actually look at carbon markets, 90% of carbon markets are your EU ETS, which is the European Union Emissions Trading Scheme. It's like cap and trade in the European Union. To allow developing countries to participate, you would have to look at what their projected or suppressed demand is, or they would never be able to commercially or viably integrate themselves. So it's an explicit decision by the UN to open the door to African countries to carbon markets to look at their suppressed demand for energy.
Three liters.
So all water use of filtered water. So we don't track all water use. We track the water use of the water that's being filtered. 2.96 is about 72% of the water that has been filtered. The additional amount is being used for non-health related. So they like it so much because it cleans out the turbidity. They notice the taste that they use it for bathing children or feeding livestock. So they use it for what are considered non-health or non-creditable purposes. So the only thing that counts towards the carbon markets are for three things. That's drinking water, washing their hands, or washing fruits and vegetables that they eat raw. Other questions?
I have a question related to what are you measuring actually in the outcomes. For example, do you have the opportunity to estimate what is the total cost of burning fuel right now, the wood, for example, how much it costs for each household, what they are currently in comparison with having access to the three devices you provide to them? And you are trying to measure the impact on productivity, given the fact they have more time right now to do other things instead of cutting the wood.
So there is a sustainability or development matrix that we have to follow with those indicators, some around productivity, some around time spent in school for the girl children in the area. And those take a longer time to measure. Our first step is to measure the health impact. The other indicators we're following, but they're a little bit more difficult to follow. Cost impact, cost effectiveness, we definitely are. The amount of wood used and saved also is a tricky one because it's connected with this idea of suppressed demand. So while we get an idea of how much is saved, it can be linked to, there's so many confounders, it's very difficult to link those two. So that's one of the limitations of the project for sure.
And also, how do you classify right now the status of the project? Do you think, are you thinking of expanding the project to other areas or other countries? Or are you thinking what you have right now contained to a single area?
So
what are the plans for the future for the project?
Plans for the future. Of course. So we are looking at, we would love to be able to take a project like this to scale, absolutely. Carbon markets, as I said, are somewhat volatile right now, so that complicates things a little bit. But we also realize that a company like ours can upfront $30 million once. To take something like this to scale, we wouldn't ever be able to continue to upfront capital like that. We wouldn't have it. And the risk builds over time because these payback periods are longer. So one, it's about how do you get investors interested in a project like this. So philanthropic investors are one idea, but it's also about how do you find key partners in different countries. So while we fully implemented in Kenya, because we have a very strong network on the ground there, we've had interest from BRAC in Bangladesh, so we're in partnership with BRAC, and BRAC would be the implementing partner in Bangladesh, as well as another organization in Rwanda. So there are projects in the pipeline in Rwanda and Bangladesh. We're looking at a project in the pipeline for Myanmar, but again, it's going to be further bridging innovative finance to make them sustainable.
So this $30 million is like an upfront cost of what? The development of the device, or just the cost of each device? Or
No, the $30 million was the full cost of manufacture and deployment of almost a million filters to the 900,000 households.
Anyway, do you have any other questions? Anyway, thank you very much for being here, and thank you for this extraordinary presentation. Thank you.